Lorenz, you came back.
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? One never discusses a woman's age, Michael.
You are listening to Screamfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. After 60 years, Mary Poppins returns. With Emily Blunt stepping into the Oscar-winning legacy of Julie Andrews, Poppins automatically has massive expectations to live up to the charm of the original Disney classic. But is the result practically perfect in every way? Or does the sequel go fly a kite? In a supercalifragilisticexpialidocious conversation, I'm joined by Seeing and Believing co-host Kevin McLenathan to discuss whether or not this film steps in time to the original, the power of perspective, and, in a special segment, our top three movie moments of 2018. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish.
Off we go.
Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited this week to talk about Mary Poppins Returns, the sequel to the original 1964 film starring Julie Andrews. What I'm most excited about, though, is that Kevin McLenathan joins us again. Welcome, Kevin. I'm so glad you could be here.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here, too. Thanks for having me on, Steve.
It seems to be our tradition now, Kevin. This is the first podcast of the year. I think it's actually our third time in a row doing that.
Yeah, you know, I guess you're right. I hadn't really thought of it, but you're right. We did this last year as well. So, and I guess we did the year before too.
We did. Well, happy anniversary. And I didn't get you anything, so I'm sorry. I will raise a chalice to you in honor of Seeing and Believing. I don't even know if you guys still do raise the chalice to one another anymore.
You know, the Seeing and Believing chalice it still exists, and it's still my possession. I have it somewhere in the apartment, but we haven't broken it out for a long time, it's true.
Well, we are so glad that you're here, and, you know, Kevin, since it is the first podcast of the year, I mean, everybody this time of year does their top 10 lists, and I don't want to do that. but something that we have done before, I was wondering if you would like to do our top three movie moments. This, of course, can be from any film we've seen. It doesn't have to be in one we thought was our top 10 films of the year, but just moments of impact that we found were particularly special in films that we've seen.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And like we were talking about before we started recording, it's a nice way to get some more idiosyncrasies into the conversation about the best films of the year, because there are kind of the usual cream of the crop that get mentioned a lot at the end of the year when you talk about just whole movies. When you talk about moments, you get a little bit more variety. You kind of get a sense more of what an individual critic finds really interesting just about cinema in general. So I really enjoy the idea myself.
All right, great. Well, Kevin, since you're the guest, why don't you go first? What would you find your number? Let's do our top three. What's your number three movie moment of the year?
Well, I guess my number three, if I had to pick one, would be a scene from a pretty modest movie that came out at the end of September called The Old Man and the Gun. And this was a film that was directed by David Lowery and was kind of pushed on its being the last acting role for Robert Redford. You know, it was sort of his swan song as an actor. You know, it's really modest in its ambitions, right? It's not like a Black Panther that's got a lot of special effects. It's not like a Roma where it's really shooting for Oscar gold and just blowing your mind with how ambitious it is. It's just a small story about an older man who is a bank robber, and he robs banks, and he's very polite. And that's basically the core of the movie. But what I really like about it is that David Lowery finds so many ways to inject little moments of cinematic magic into that really modest story. So my number three moment is one of these little nuggets. It's the moment where Robert Redford shares a first kiss with his love interest in the film, Sissy Spacek. They've just been out on a date. They've been seeing each other for a while, but there's some tentativeness around how they've acted around each other. But at the end of this date, he drives her back into her her house, and he walks her to her front door. He leaves her, but then he changes his mind. He comes back, and they share their first kiss. You know, it's this really, you know, almost old school romantic moment. And the moment I really want to highlight is after the kiss. The camera stays on Spacek's face as Redford's character walks back to the car and drives away. And Lowery captures the moment where Redford's car's taillights come on and just bathes Spacek's face in this really warm red glow. And that's just – it's this moment of small cinematic magic that you know, it's – not there's no CGI involved. SpaceX not, you know, the latest young actress, but in that moment you get a sense of, number one, how romantic that moment was for her character personally, and you also just get to luxuriate in that warm red color that Lowery and his cinematographer bathe the scene in. I think it's really special.
I can't agree with you more on the film. The film is so charming, and I saw the film in the film festival and still struck at the charisma of Redford and those moments where they're in the restaurants conversing with one another. I just, I wanted a full film of those. Like, there was such chemistry between the two leads, and the film is just so charming and beautiful along the way. You're right. It's very simple. If it is his last film, which it sounds like it is, it's an incredible send-off. You know, it's basically what would happen if the guy from The Sting got old.
That's a good way to describe it. I haven't heard that particular descriptor used, but that's a great summary.
Well, it just sort of is a natural wrap-up. That's one of the things I loved about the film, and it's really lovely. That's a great pick. My number three, and I keep going back and forth, I'm going to declare it a tie, and I'm going to say that I can do that because I made the rules for this game.
It's your podcast.
You that's can right. Do what you want. That's right. It's a 17-way tie. No, I'm kidding. No, there are. It's a tie with two moments, and I admit one of them is just for the sheer joy that I found, and one of them is for the sheer cultural impact, and they both come from superhero films. I have to declare it a tie between the moment in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse where Miles Morales accepts his call, and there's this sort of montage scene, but it's just the animation of a film like this is so stunning and so unique and beautiful in its own way. I found it a complete jolt of energy into what's becoming a really tired formula, just in terms of its look and its feel. And there is that moment where you sort of want to pump your fist. That's how I felt watching it. And the other one, and I'm sure this is, you just forgot to mention this in your top 10 films of the year. I have to admit, for sheer cultural impact, the finger snap in Avengers Infinity War, because I have to admit, I know the movie isn't great. It isn't. I mean, I'm impressed that they sort of balanced everything and stuff and whatnot. From a critical perspective, you can argue it to the hilt. But I never thought I would see something have such a broad net for something like a finger snap. And yes, I mean, it became this almost the, I would say song of the summer, but there was no music. And working with youth, that's all they were talking about is the finger snap. So I have to put that on as a moment of impact, even though I wouldn't say the film is in my top 10. I would say that that moment was important enough to mention from a cultural level.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't the biggest fan of Infinity War, but I'm not going to beat that dead horse any longer. I do like talking about Into the Spider-Verse, which was in my top 20 of the year. I think it's a really special film. Mm-hmm. I think it's, for me, in some ways, it's sort of the superhero movie that renewed my faith in superhero movies. Mm. It's fun. It's inventive. It kind of casts off the shackles of needing to build this huge interconnected universe, and it just tells a nice self-contained story. And there might be a sequel down the road, but if we just got one Into the Spider-Verse, I would feel satisfied. And it's probably the superhero movie from the last, I don't know, 5 years that I'm most likely to revisit, just because visually and in the writing, it's just, it's such a treat. It's really good.
Yeah, that one is very special. I'm afraid that I've heard rumors of the Spider-Verse cinematic universe, which is not unexpected, I suppose. I don't want it. I know.
This is why we can't have nice things.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. You know, you don't need more, but it's just, it's something so unique. And so I thought that that film particularly was special. I know that your copy of Infinity War is burning up your 4K player. But let's not talk about that. Let's go to your second favorite moment.
Yeah, we're here to celebrate films, not rag on anything. So I'm happy moving on. My number two pick is from a movie called Widows, directed by Steve McQueen. So I live in Chicago, and I really love the city. And Widows, because it is set in Chicago and uses its setting as a very central element of the entire film, you know, I was always going to enjoy it to some extent. It's just, there's a treat to seeing your home city being up on the big screen in such a loving and big way. But there are so many moments from Widows that are just absolutely stunning. The directorial vision, the performances. And I want to highlight one scene in particular. It's a single shot. So it's one of these long takes. It's 108 seconds long. Mm-hmm. I timed it when I went back to the screener to watch it again for this list. The basic setup for it is a politician played by Colin Farrell has been holding a campaign rally in a neighborhood of Chicago where he is running for alderman. And it's a more economically depressed neighborhood. It's got some problems, and he's been giving a speech about how he's going to completely revitalize the neighborhood with all of these political initiatives that he has planned. And then McQueen's camera follows Farrell's character as he gets into a car, and the car drives to Farrell's campaign headquarters. It takes 108 seconds, and the camera never cuts away. There's no CGI. There's no trickery of any kind. The camera just sits on the hood of the car and watches. And in that less than 2 minutes, we see the neighborhood outside the car go from this more economically run-down neighborhood to this really leafy, upscale, Tony residential streets with these luxurious townhomes and very picturesque streets. And it's all done in less than 2 minutes. Less than a two-minute drive, you go from point A to point B, and there's just this stark difference. And in that shot, it's almost like Steve McQueen is telling an entire story about American society and Chicago society in particular. I think it's a bravura sequence. It's amazing, the location scouting that must have gone into finding that particular stretch to drive on.
Yeah.
And it's the sort of thing that when you have a great director like Steve McQueen at the helm, that's the kind of great moment that you get out of a film like Widows.
It's funny because this is where I get to say, this is why we don't get to have nice things. Because the thing that frustrated me most about Widows is that no one went to see it. And I love the moment you're talking about. It's just one of those things that sticks with you after it's done. And it's just so smooth and mm-hmm. compelling. And that's just great filmmaking. And McQueen takes what could be a staunch thriller, but his direction and the cast take it up to a level that I found I really appreciated. And that's just a beautiful, beautiful scene. Good pick.
Yeah, the film as a whole wasn't one of my favorites of the year. Mm. Partly because I think the film never really tops that moment. It's almost right. like McQueen says so much of what he wants to say in 2 minutes, and then the rest is sort of window dressing and scaffolding, which just doesn't make it a bad film, but it's just such a bravura shot that you can't really go anywhere after he basically tells the story of an entire neighborhood in a city just through 108 seconds.
It's true. It's true. That's fair. My number two is a little bit different. I'm not going to lie, but it doesn't involve superheroes. So breathe a sigh of relief. maybe because it does come with a music theme. Since we're speaking about moments, again, going back to moments, the Live Aid concert at the conclusion of Bohemian Rhapsody was one of those moments. It doesn't have the cinematic beauty of what you're talking about with what you saw in Widows, but I was so impressed at how true to life it felt. And one of the things I felt about that particular film, which wouldn't be in my top 10 of the year, I don't think. Like, personally, I know it's got some buzz and it's got some momentum, but it probably wouldn't be in my top 10. But one of the things that that moment does is validate what I think is the whole point of the film, is that the image is what they value as truth. And going back and watching the original Live Aid afterwards, let's be serious, I wasn't old enough at the time to have been actively interested in that. But they really sought for authenticity in those moments, whereas they, felt they could play fast and loose with it with others in the film. But that there was something about that performance. Rami Malek really seeks to step into the role. And when I left the film, that was all I could talk about, was that moment.
Yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody is one of those films that I hadn't actually gotten around to before making my end of the year list. There's just so much else coming out in November and December. And to be honest, the buzz around it wasn't that great. So I just prioritized other films. But I have heard that the big moment that you're talking about, the Live Aid concert, is a standout, and rightfully so. And I have not seen Rami Malek in the movie, obviously, but I know he's a great performer, and I can imagine his magnetism dialed up to 11, making that a very exceptional moment in 2018 cinema.
Yeah, it's an astounding performance, that scene. It really is, to be honest. It certainly makes its point well, and his performance is incredible. What is your number one moment of the year, Kevin?
Well, my number one is another film that I didn't have in my top 20 films of the year, but in a lot of ways, I feel as if this film is the most essential movie of the year, if I can make that distinction. Mm. It's Won't You Be My Neighbor. It's Morgan Neville's documentary about Mr. Rogers. And the moment that I'm thinking of comes almost right at the very end. After taking us through all of Mr. Rogers' life, up through his death, Neville gives us this almost montage of the interview subjects who have popped up over the course of the documentary. And he leads it with an anecdote about how one of Mr. Rogers' favorite things to encourage people to do was to think back to when they were small or when they were children and think about the loved ones, the friends, the family who loved them as children and who helped them and who helped them become the person they are today, helped them come to adulthood, and to be grateful for those people. And then Neville just cuts from interview subject to interview subject. It's a very quiet moment. Most of them don't say anything. One of them kind of says softly under his breath that he's thinking about his mother. And that moment is, it's not really about Fred Rogers himself. It's more about being grateful for the people we know, the people we love. And with 2018 being in some ways so defined by sort of this warfare, this cultural warfare, the idea that, you know, you don't believe the same things I believe, you're my enemy, you know, where so much of our lives online and offline are kind of defined by conflict, and where so much of just online culture in general is all about, you know, thinking about yourself, promoting your personal brand, just this constant rush. That moment in Won't You Be My Neighbor just encouraged us all to slow down and think about the people who lifted us up and made us who we are. And it's the perfect moment for that film, because it's not about Mr. Rogers. It's about what he helped us think about. And I, you know, I don't think Mr. Rogers would have had it any other way. And also it kind of sends you out into the theater thinking about, who are the people I love in my own life? Who helped me to be who I am today? And I think remembering those things, being mindful of them and being grateful for them, is a great antidote for a lot of what ails us in our current time. So I just, I love that moment, and the movie as a whole just feels like a tonic, like a salve for your wounded heart in 2018 and beyond.
You know, I haven't seen it, and I feel ashamed.
Really?
Yeah, I missed it. And I don't know a single person that has seen the movie that didn't love it. It's like a warm hug in a way that just, it just points you in the right direction. And that's, everyone I know that has seen the film absolutely feels the same way, that maybe it isn't the best film of the year, but it impacted them maybe more than any other film this year.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those movies. I think there are two groups of people in the world: people who admit to crying during Won't You Be My Neighbor, and liars. It's one of those movies that, again, like as a documentary, I'm not sure that the craft is all that impressive, but in some ways, because it's so stylistically unobtrusive, it doesn't get in its own way, and it lets Mr. Rogers' heart kind of shine forth. And that's really all it needed to do. And he was, you know, he has a lot to teach us. So it's, I definitely encourage you to check it out. I think it's on Amazon Prime, so it shouldn't be too hard to find.
Yeah, I'll check that out. And I know, of course, they're making a dramatic film with Tom Hanks in the lead, which, you know, is pretty easy casting, you know, unless you want to go with like Steve Buscemi, or, you know, mix it up a little.
I would watch a Steve Buscemi starring biopic of Mr. Rogers. That sounds insane. And I would eat it up.
By Tarantino. Anyway. My number one movie moment is not from what I thought would be the best film of the year, but it is, would be in my top 10. And I felt was one of the more important films of the year as well, to be honest with you. It's from Eighth Grade, which directed and written by Bo Burnham, which is a fascinating thing in and of itself, how a man in his 30s can write so well for a grade 8 girl. But this moment that really highlighted for me the impact, and of course this partially stems too because I work with youth, but there's a beautiful moment in the film where she's sitting around a bonfire with her father and going through her future box that she made 2 years earlier as she entered middle school, and is sort of going through her things, and the whole movie is about this young girl who is leaving eighth grade and moving into high school and trying to figure out who she is. It's heartwarming and tragic at the same time. And there's this scene where she's speaking with her father, and her father gets to speak into her life in a way that I found very touching. And I just thought that the film was surprisingly honest and very well done.
Yeah. Eighth Grade is a really wonderful, wonderful film that I agonized for so long over whether it would make the cut into my top 10. Just there were so many movies clamoring for that spot. But you hit on something that I think is really instrumental to why it's so great. It's got this, it's just such a sensitive portrait of a person at that time in their lives. I can imagine a version of this movie where it's sort of almost getting off on putting her through humiliation after humiliation and sort of inviting the audience to sort of cringe at it and remember their own mortifying experiences. And that's in the movie, but it's more, it's not the reason for the movie existing. You know, it's not a cringe comedy. It's a lot more humane than that. And that scene around the bonfire you mentioned is really emblematic of that trait.
Yeah. There's something so special about that film. And again, nobody saw it. But it's such a powerful portrait of the modern youth experience in a lot of ways, and has a lot to say. So that was one of my, easily one of my top 10 films of the year for me.
Yeah.
In that moment.
I have a feeling that this, even though not many people saw it in the theater, this movie is going to have a long life on home release. This is the sort of movie that, you know, parents should be watching with their kids, that, you know, teachers should be showing in school when they, you know, have movie time or whatever happens in schools these days. I don't know.
I agree.
Like it's going to have legs, which makes me really happy because it's a strong film.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, those are great picks, Kevin. And thank you so much for sharing them with me. I'm going to have to get caught up on Won't You Be My Neighbor. But since we've been talking about some of our favorite films of the year, let's talk about a film that had a lot of anticipation going into this year. And that movie is Mary Poppins Returns. Mary Poppins Returns picks up 20 years after the original film, even though it was filmed in 1964. And now an adult with three children, bank teller Michael Banks learns that his house will be repossessed in 5 days unless he can pay back a loan. His only hope is to find a missing certificate that shows proof of valuable shares that his father left him years earlier. Just as all seems lost, Michael and his sister receive the surprise of a lifetime when Mary Poppins arrives to save the day and take the banks on a magical, fun-filled adventure, starring Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda. Kevin, what did you think of Mary Poppins Returns?
You know, I went into this movie with pretty low expectations, and part of that has to do with my general reaction to most of the Disney remakes that have come out in the last couple of years. For example, the remake of Beauty and the Beast that starring Emma Watson as Belle and Dan Stevens as the Beast in some ways kind of represents the overall trend where it's not terrible, but it doesn't have a whole lot of magic to it. It feels a lot like it was driven by calculation. Like they know that it's a big nostalgia bomb and people will see it for that reason. And they don't really give you a reason to see it if you don't have nostalgia for that particular film. So going into Mary Poppins Returns, I was sort of like, oh, this is going to be another one of these films where it's technically competent but devoid of magic. And that's not really what I found waiting for me in the theater. I had a good time with the movie overall. I think that – I mean it doesn't draw a level with the – original, of course, because very few movies do. But I think that the gameness of Emily Blunt as Poppins and the overall strength of the performers around her and, for the most part, the material they're given is strong enough to kind of carry you through the whole film. And it does, to some extent, capture some of the same magic of the original, where a lot of it is just a lark of a musical that you're watching because you want to enjoy the songs, you want to watch some fun dancing, and you want to watch some charismatic performers. And Mary Poppins Returns has that, and I think it succeeds overall. I think there's some odd choices that are made that are probably a necessity of having it be essentially a sequel to a movie that doesn't really call for one. But we can get into that a little bit later. I think it's overall a good effort. What did you think of it?
You know, I feel similar to you, to what you were saying there in terms of going in with low expectations. I felt like, First of all, if it's trying to be the original film, then it's going to feel slavish to the original, and that's going to prevent it from having its own purpose, and it's just going to feel like the next thing that they're doing. I mean, I think they've got three of them this year that are remakes of their own properties that are coming out in 2019 alone. But, you know, I was taken in by it. I really was. It doesn't have to live up to the original. It doesn't have to surpass the original. But it just does needs to feel more necessary. Like there's some sort of logical progression. And I felt like there was something there. I really did. It really was sort of like watching sunshine and rainbows for 2 hours. In a good way, though. You know, I agree with you. I think Blunt is a lovely successor for the mantle of Mary Poppins. She does a wonderful job, which amazes me because Blunt has been on my radar very little over the past few years. And this year, between A Quiet Place and this film, she's on my radar. And it's not that I hadn't seen her in things. I didn't feel like the roles she was getting sort of brought out the best in her. And this was one of those ones. I thought that she was game, and the musical numbers were beautiful to see. I was intrigued by the fact that they did fight hard to not over CGI it. And I know that they're doing CGI, so let me be careful when I say that. But I mean, for example, in the animation, it doesn't look like, say, The Lion King. They're not going for realism. They're looking for the same style of almost 2D animation that you got in the original, and they're sort of pulling you into that same sort of world. And, you know, I mean, is it a perfect film? No, but I did think that it was really enjoyable, and it was very sweet and charming and fun to watch.
Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of point in sort of trying to resist the film because it's, you know, because it's not exactly what you wanted out of it. Yeah. Because I think part of a film like Mary Poppins or Mary Poppins Returns is not having that spirit of, you know, having your arms crossed and sort of like, okay, movie, wow me. You know, there has to be a little bit of buy-in. And I think that Rob Marshall's choice to stylize the film in certain ways makes it easy to buy in that way. The costumes are really good, and he also does something interesting with the setting of London, where he does allow it to kind of almost be gritty in some ways. I mean, it's set during the Great Depression, essentially, and we see all sorts of street life that is not, you know, magical Disneyland kind of stuff. But he also fills it with choices that make the setting seem more like an idea of London rather than a gritty London. You know, like when I think back to, say, the Beauty and the Beast remake, which was really kind of obviously set in 1700s France around that time, there were all these choices in costuming, in the setting, in the dialogue that were obviously straining for situating it in this very specific historical period. And it really – that detracted from a lot of the magic that you want out of a fairy tale like Beauty and the Beast. In Mary Poppins Returns, there is a lot of that ground level – more real world stuff, but it also is applied in a way that felt staged in a good way. It felt stylized in a way that, again, again, made it easy for you to open your hearts to the movie, I guess, if I could use a cheesy turn of phrase like that.
Well, I mean, absolutely. This is not Dickens's London. You know, I don't think he was in the Great Depression either. But, I mean, you know, they don't want it to feel, like, overbearing. And the opening musical number is Miranda going on a bicycle talking about the beautiful London town. And so it's shadowy and somehow darkened, but he's singing about how beautiful it is if you really knew what London was. They want you to feel warm somehow, maybe warm isn't the word, safe in a bit of an unsafe world. And I thought that was something that kept coming through in the film. Although I am waiting for the gritty reboot, which features a Jets versus Sharks dance-off between the lamplighters and the chimney sweeps of the two films.
I'm team chimney sweeps in that fight.
That's fair. But they didn't have motorbikes. These guys were ready to go. And no. And I think you're right. There has to be buy-in. I mean, Mary Poppins at one point, doesn't she say, you know, some people think too much, Michael. and you know, if that had been earlier on in the film, I would have assumed it was a direct shot at critics saying, hey, lighten up. There's such enthusiasm and joy in the musical numbers. Rob Marshall wanted the film to have the feel of a film from the, you know, mid-50s to late 60s, and with that musical whimsy, and I thought that he managed that. It's a very different style than you're going to see in, say, A Star is Born or Bohemian Rhapsody. But it's the type of musical that wants you to feel joy by the end of it, and I think he succeeds. Excuse me, my goodness, I'm coughing. I sounded like the old banker at the end. But Kevin, of course, one of the things worth talking about maybe here. The first film, of course, came out in the mid-60s, and then we have this other one, which is roughly, I'm going to do my math wrong. It's 45 years later, roughly 45 years later?
55.
55, see, there you go. I was an English major, so that's my problem.
Yeah, same here, no judgment.
I was wondering, you know, how do you feel it compares to the film? The original, and I know the original is considered a classic, but even the worlds that they come out of, and do you find them similar? Do you find them different in that regard?
I mean, the thing about the original movie is it's a very episodic film, right? Like Mary Poppins comes and she says, you know, I'm going to be the nanny, and she and the children go on adventures, and there's kind of an overall through line involving Mr. Banks, the father, and his emotional journey from being this stuffed shirt guy kind of obsessed with money and personal prestige and his career. And he comes out of that by the end of the classic film. But the movie isn't really about that so much as like Mary Poppins doesn't come to bring that outcome about. It's right. More like she comes, I'm the nanny, and I'm going to encounter lots of adventures and conflicts while I'm the nanny, but I'm not here to do anything. And I think that's a big difference between the original and this film, where Mary Poppins basically shows up to save the day. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but it is very different. Mm. And it calls on her character to do and be different things. And I don't think she works quite as well as a savior figure as she does in the original film, where she's essentially kind of almost a fairy. You know, she's kind of like this magical being that comes and fills their lives with magic. And then the characters grow in response to that, rather than her coming down and essentially dispensing life lessons and then making big bang and, you know, then working her magic on Big Ben in order to make sure that the final climax has a happy ending, you know, like that. It's a different kind of movie because of those things, and yeah, because of that, the episodic nature that's present in both films, it works in the older one. In the newer one, which is trying much more to have a very focused narrative and is trying to do very specific things with its social commentary, that kind of kicks against the episodic structure a little bit more than the original did, because the original didn't saddle itself with all of those extra bells and whistles.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but you're right. In fact, I think if I'm correct, and I might be wrong, in the original, she leaves because the wind changes, if I'm right. In this one, she leaves because the door opens. So it's much more tied to the events of what's taking place in the story. I hadn't thought of that until you said that. There's much more of a purpose for Emily Blunt arriving now than it was for Julie Andrews to arrive before. So certainly that does, you're right, that does change the way that things sort of unravel. And that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
And it also it means that when you do kind of have these rabbit trails where there's kind of this scene where they go and meet a character who's Mary Poppins's cousin, I think, played by played by Meryl Streep. And it's not that it's a bad scene or that the song isn't any good or that it's not fun, but because the movie is kind of all about making sure that the Banks family home is saved and that the kids find a way to, you know, find a bank deed that allows them to pay off a certain loan, the rabbit trail feels a lot more. It slows down the film's momentum.
It's a little forced. A little forced.
Right. Whereas in the first film, you know, there's the part where they visit the guy and they sing that song "I Love to Laugh," and they're, you know, they're not really there for anything. There's no real particular narrative reason why that scene has to be in the film, but it's okay because the entire film is filled up with scenes like that where they just kind of go and they have encounters and adventures.
Right.
And they're there for their own sake. It's just the two films work in a different way, and I think the original kind of knows what it is a lot better than the sequel does.
In comparing the two films, with the difference, a significant difference in time, you know, I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go back and just sort of look at the cultural events of 1964. I mean, I'm Canadian, so I just want to refresh my American history. But I have to admit, like, I forgot how much was happening within the 2 years, like 63, 64. I mean, you had, of course, I knew there was Vietnam was going on, the Civil Rights Act, Women's Liberation Movement, of course, was going on. That's in the first film because, which in some ways is interesting because the mother is far more political than the daughter is in this one, even though she's actively political. You know, there's no marching song like there is in the first one where they put the sashes on and all that stuff. But there was, of course, there's Civil Rights Act. And it never even occurred to me that it was post-Kennedy. That was interesting, too. Looking at this story of a woman who appears out of nowhere in the midst of chaos and brings hope, I thought, well, that's very interesting. Because when you look at now, of course, what do we have? We have racial tension. We have Me Too. We have a president that... Well, you have a president.
Unfortunately.
We have a prime minister, but they're very different. You have a president who day by day is unraveling something, or something is unraveling about him. And I thought, my gosh, the time periods don't strike me as that different. When you look at the culture around you and the things that are going on, and this is, you know, over 50 years later. And the interesting thing that I thought, and this occurred to me, I thought, well, okay, well, they must have started this film after the election in 2016, and it's a direct statement. They went into the film pre-production a year and a half before that. It was in 2015, before he was even running. And I thought, this is fascinating. Like, the timing of the two films seem very related to their culture, and the messages that they're offering aren't that different. You know, you're right. The first film is very much about being the nanny for the Banks children. That's fine, but that's absolutely true. But I also found, like, the messages of the two films, because, of course, Mr. Banks in the first one, you know, what do? They go fly a kite. And this one literally ends on a number that's called "Nowhere to Go But Up." it just made me wonder, you know, how bad the world is going to be to get a third film.
Well, it's funny because, you know, every time period has its own difficulties.
Sure,
right?
Like, of course.
There's never going to be a time where there's not some sort of social upheaval going on. I'm not sure that, like, the fact that we have a Mary Poppins movie is specifically a response to anything in particular.
Right.
But you do see certain things working themselves out in the finished product that are pretty interesting. There is a lot of foregrounding, even though we don't see Jane in this movie, who she's a labor organizer. And at one point, the film kind of hints at the fact that there's a lot of tension and concern over socialists and anarchists coming into countries like Britain and causing havoc. The response to Jane's work is hinted at, hints at that kind of dynamic. But I think to the context of the original film, where we have the suffragettes, that was sort of a political cause that was kind of safely in the past almost. It was sort of like we can look at Mrs. Banks being a suffragette, and it's sort of like, well, we fixed that problem. And
right.
So her character reads as someone who's fighting a battle that we already know has been won. We know how that story ends. In this film, though, with the labor organizing subplot, I mean, that's a very here and now kind of social issue that the film is choosing to comment on.
Hmm.
And that's that gives those moments of potency that maybe the original didn't have. I'm not sure that it's necessarily constructive for a kids movie to tackle something that weighty, but it is interesting to think about how much of that tension was intentional and how much of it is an accident of the film's release.
Right. And I'm not suggesting that Mary Poppins Returns is the political film we've all been waiting for, but I do think it's an interesting response to a time in the same way that the first one was. One of the things that I found about this particular film is that it continues to push the idea of finding our way in a dark time. I was wondering where you think the film lands on that and how to do it, how to do so.
It's interesting to see this film differ from the original in that there is a villain character in Mary Poppins Returns. And in the original Mary Poppins, there were there were the bankers, and they were kind of antagonists in that film, but they weren't sort of the antagonist. They were sort of part of a subplot that was resolved without too much issue, I guess. And in the original, literally Mr. Banks tells a joke and it's solved. So it's, you know, it's not the same level. In this one, there's a villainy that's much more conscious and much more present in all of their lives. And that in itself is kind of interesting in what it implies about the film's view of the world's problems and their causes. And the film's response to that is to remember what's important, essentially. So when Michael Banks is at his lowest moment, he comes to realize that what's really important isn't money or jobs or a house, it's family, it's his loved ones, his children, the people around him. And he arrives at that epiphany maybe a little bit more easily than I would have liked. It would have been nice to see a little bit more struggle there so that the weight of that realization hits with a little bit more force. But I think it is a very it's a nice theme to see explored in a major release like this, to call us to remember what's important and to not get so bogged down in the here and now. I mean, we talked about Won't You Be My Neighbor earlier in this episode, and I think in some ways there's some sympathies between those two worldviews, the idea that the important thing is people and the people around you and loving each other well. And it's nice to see that in this film, kind of buttressing up the themes that we see in that other film as well.
I'm glad you said that about loving each other well. I think that really plays into this and the value of people. I mean, you see that with the bank, you know, of course. What do they say? You know, Colin Firth, of course, being the villain. But when Dick Van Dyke comes in, you know, oh, if I'd known the son of George Banks were here, you know, it's like, oh, I remember you. It's you know, there's this emphasis of love and people, and actually a romantic subplot for the, I would say Jack is the character, but you know, still taking on that role that Dick Van Dyke took on in the original. There's this focus on people, but also perspective. I asked that almost as a question because I thought it was fascinating that when, you know, we talked a little bit before about, you know, the atmosphere, and it could have been shot that London is far more foreboding, but they don't even call it the Depression. They call it the Great Slump, which is a very different term, that we're going through a slump right now. It's actually a hopeful depressive turn. You know, a slump implies that there's going to be an uptick. The Great Depression implies that this is over. You know, there's an entire musical number devoted to following or stepping into the dark and embracing the light that's in there. I mean, well, even Jack's character is someone who goes around turning on little lights and trying to remind people, don't worry, it's not so bad. And in the midst of that are these relationships. And again, that last number is there's nowhere to go but up. There's this idea that there still is hope in the midst of a moment which seems insurmountable. You know, he's going to lose the house. And at the last moment, they find a bank statement taped to the back of the kite. You know, and don't worry, it's going to work out. We're going to get through this together. I thought was a beautiful, beautiful theme, and better, more effectively executed in this than it was in the Christopher Robin film that we saw in the summer.
I can't help but be a little bit disappointed in the resolution of like, oh, we've had this thing all along, just because it reduces the conflict from being about realizing what's really important to, well, just be a prudent investor.
Yeah, that's true.
It's such an odd note to end on a film for a film that's all about like the magic, remember the magic of childhood and, you know, remember what's important and all that. So it's a bit of a bum note, but I am glad that you brought up the theme of perspective, because that's something that really is all over this movie. There's that musical number with the lamplighters about when you're in a dark place and shining light into that place, the closing number, nowhere to go but up. And then there's also the Meryl Streep number is also very much about perspective. The very first number with Mary Poppins, can you imagine that, where the lyrics take the perspective of, well, it's ridiculous to believe ridiculous things, but, you know, a change in perspective is all it takes to realize that maybe it's not so ridiculous after all. Maybe there's a lot of good to be found in those things as well. And that is a theme that courses throughout this movie, and it would have been nice to see it really embrace that a little bit more strongly, rather than giving us a little bit more of a, if it was really going to go all in on the Colin Firth as a villainous banker plot, I would have liked to have seen it really lean into how the theme of perspective played on that.
I'm glad you brought up the bum note about being a prudent investor, because that was one of the things I felt, just the idea that, wait a second, are they just saying that, don't worry, not all bankers are bad? Most of them are good. I was like, Disney shareholders, don't worry. Do not fear us.
I would not be a bit surprised.
Oh, come now, Kevin. Surely you don't think that Disney is a corporate entity. I mean, that's it's all about whimsy.
How could I even ever get that idea?
No, I refuse to believe that. That's I'm just going to dive backwards into my bathtub and you'll see. It's, no. Kevin, I think just for time and I love chatting with you and I think this is great, but I think it's a good time for us to start wrapping up. We should screen it or skip it. Mary Poppins, screen it or skip it.
You know, I think it's worth the screen it. I had a good time with it. And especially if you have young kids, I think they will as well. I think if I can tell a short anecdote, the one thing that raised my opinion of the film by maybe a half star was that my wife and I were sitting in the theater next to a family. They had two little girls. And during the big climax at Big Ben, the little girl on one side of us literally pumped her fist and said, "Yeah," when they succeeded in their quest. And she was just so invested. She was all in on this movie. And, you know, if it's doing that for small children and the craft is as strong as it is here, I think it's worth it.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a screen it for me. It's a lovely film. You could wait to see this one at home, I suppose, but why would you? I mean, if you're interested in seeing it, it's beautiful on the big screen. It's just dazzling with the set design and the colors. There's so much to see. I think it's a screen it. I think it's a lot of fun and wonderful family film. So I agree. Kevin, as always, I love having you on. Thank you so much for joining me. Why don't you tell us what's going on with Seeing and Believing?
Well, Seeing and Believing, where we also are back from our Christmas vacation. Last Friday, we put up our top 10 of the year episode. So if anyone's interested in checking out to see what Wade's and my favorite films of 2018 were, they can go to christandpopculture.com and stream the episode. Or if they want to download it from iTunes, you can find our podcast, Seeing and Believing, on there.
Great. Oh, that's great. It's appreciate you both. And I'm looking forward to hearing that because I'm sure that there's some gems on there that even I've missed at this stage. So I'm looking forward to hearing that episode. And again, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always a really good time. Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Anytime. And for all of you at home, a reminder that you can check us out on the podcast page where you can download Fishing for More, some small group questions that if you want to talk about it with the people that you see Mary Poppins Returns with. And of course, you can find the podcast anywhere, pretty much anywhere, major places you can get your podcast, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. So again, thanks so much, Kevin. And as always, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.